The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart on August 5th left the community reeling and the public searching for answers after 22 Latino and Mexican individuals were killed. The admitted gunman, a 21-year-old white male, posted a disturbing manifesto online 19 minutes before the attack. It spouts anti-immigrant and white nationalism beliefs that mimic those of national political leaders and right-wing talking heads. This, as Fox News opinion person Tucker Carlson told his audience, that the threat of white supremacy is a hoax.
The whole thing is a lie. If you were to assemble a list, a hierarchy of concerns or problems this country faces, where would white supremacy be on the list? Right up there with Russia, probably. It's actually not a real problem in America. The combined membership of every white supremacist organization in this country would be able to fit inside a college football stadium? White supremacy, that's the problem. This is a hoax, just like the Russia hoax. It's a conspiracy theory used to divide the country and keep a hold on power. That's exactly what's going on.
The Anti-Defamation League recently reported that right-wing extremists were linked to more murders in the United States, at least 50 in 2018, which is more than any year since 1995 when Timothy McVeigh bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building. In the last decade, roughly 73% of extremist-related killings have been associated with domestic right-wing extremists, relative to about 23% attributed to Islamic extremists. White supremacists have been tied to deadly rampages over the past year at synagogues in Pittsburgh and Poway, California, and possibly to a mass shooting at a garlic festival in California targeting Latinos, and now we have El Paso. Who are these white supremacists? How have they been radicalized? What's been done on the internet? Is the internet related to this? What can we do to stop them? What's the long-term damage that this trend could have if more isn't done to stop them? You can call in with your questions and comments. We really welcome you into this conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. How do you feel after El Paso? Do you feel different? Does everything feel different to you? 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined with Tony McAleer. He's a former skinhead recruiter, co-founder, and board chair of Life After Hate. He's the author of a forthcoming book, The Cure for Hate, A Former White Supremacist Journey from Violent Extremism to Radical Compassion. Tony McAleer, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
And Brian Levin's here. He's a director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. Brian Levin, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much.
So, Tony, your story, it's an incredible, compelling story. Tell us about your journey, because I think this is really something that more people should hear. So tell us that.
Well, I started out in a middle class, affluent neighborhood. I didn't come from, you know, an obviously broken family. And I grew up in a household where it wasn't safe to be emotionally open. You know, when we come into the world, nobody comes into the world as a neo-Nazi. People come in, you think of who you were when you came into the world at the age of, by the age of three or four. Little Tony was this bright, curious, mischievous, stubborn, a little bit defiant, a little guy that was open to the world. And, you know, life happens to us. It's part of the human condition. It's part of living. And I was pretty okay until I was about nine, ten. And I walked in on my father with another woman. And that really threw my world upside down. And what happened was the God fell off the pedestal of my father, and I felt betrayed by the authority figures in my life. And And I became very angry, right? And the next year at school, I went to an all-boys Catholic school. My grades went from A's and B's down to sort of C's and D's. And they tried all kinds of things to use the carrot to motivate me. But in the end, the teacher and my parents got together. They decided they'd beat the grades into me. And if I didn't get an A or a B on major tests and assignments, I was hit on the rear end with a yardstick. First time it was 2, then it was 4, then it was 6 times. Then every time after that, it was 8. And I don't think I've ever felt more powerless to this day than I did in that office over and over and over again. And I went from listening to Elton John and Queen to The Clash and the Sex Pistols and got into the punk scene. I ended up leaving that school at the end of grade 9 and going to boarding school in England for a year, when I got introduced to the skinhead scene, which was kind of like punk, but at the time, and they were sort of nationalist, but not super racist. There was a racist element to it. And that's kind of where it started when I came back to Vancouver, and there was a skinhead band called Screwdriver, and they sang. They came out with the very first single called "White Power," which blew the doors off of the whole music scene. And there was now a music genre around the racism, but it was still very disorganized. It was sort of chaotic street kind of stuff. But it only took a couple of years before the older, more established racist groups made contact with this sort of raucous white power skinheads, and that began and in that way, in many ways, that's sort of symbolic or metaphoric for how this ideology works with young people. You take this sort of coarse violence and alienation and discontent, and then you offer it an ideology that puts a framework around the anger that you're already feeling.
And did they point towards you to say they knew that you were dealing with a lot of anger, not a hate, and they say white power and look at these, the other, and directed you to that. And then you had a group around you. Now you felt different, that empowered you?
Absolutely. And I just want to be very clear here. I don't blame anything that happened to anything that I did on my childhood. Everything I did, I chose to do, and I have to take accountability for that. I hold a healthy shame about the violence and that I did and the things that I said. But I want to give you a context. I want to help you understand the foundation from which I made those choices.
Yeah.
And it's, if you imagine going to the grocery store. Have you ever gone to the grocery store when you're really hungry and you notice you make different choices, right? I sort of used that analogy and said I went out into the world emotionally hungry, and I made the worst junk food choices possible that provide a moment of satisfaction and are utterly empty and damaging, not just to me, but to everyone around me. And so it's coming from that place where I felt powerless, I felt unlovable, I felt invisible. And what being part of that skinhead scene and later the movement and the suit and tie activities I got into, I got to see the feeling of power when I felt powerless. I got attention when I felt invisible, and I got brotherhood, camaraderie, and acceptance.
So that seems like that's the toxic recipe that's causing some people to turn towards white supremacy, white nationalism, the violence that's connected to that. We're going to talk more about the situation, how some young people are being radicalized online. If you've got a question or a comment, the number is 210-614-8980, 614-8980. A 1-minute break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about white supremacism, white supremacist, and how people are being radicalized online, and how this can lead to what we saw in places like El Paso. Brian Levin is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. Brian, so you heard Tony McAleer's story about how he suffered a childhood trauma. He felt isolated. He found a circle of people who would embrace him. Then they had a hate ideology, and he took that to heart. Is that untypical?
No, it's fairly typical, although what I would say is when he went to boarding school, he cleaved from his family a bit earlier than the folks that we've been seeing committing some of the more horrid acts of domestic terrorism. But yeah, his story is one that I think would routinely come up with those who are extremists, and that's why he's so valuable to our cause. He's articulate, but more than that, he has the street cred that he lived it.
And so, Brian Levin, as you look at El Paso, for example, we have this narrative that's come about. This a young man drove from the Dallas area down to El Paso, and he was a lone wolf, and he was well armed, and he had the intent, a manifesto, and the intent to kill Latinos. So, is this a continuation of a trend? Is this a new thing? Is this an old thing, Brian? What are you seeing here?
We're in the first several innings, and you know when I sent our we just came out with a report, and folks are able to read it. It's 137 pages where we talked about this exact trend of young folks acting out in their region, in their state or region, and a lot of them are I don't want to say self-radicalized, but for lack of a better word, there's an ecosystem. And so what I told Congress earlier in the year was, in our written testimony, contemporary extremism is both decentralized and influenced by increasingly deep domestic political and social divisions that are in turn often connected to transnational populism. As autonomous loners and small cells continue to diversify that threat, most actors are inspired by combining an array of scripted prejudices, past iconic terror figures, and political grievances into their own mix of specific idiosyncratic justifications.
So,
and we had something similar in our report, which just came out just a couple of weeks ago. And again, it's on our pinned tweet at Prof. Levin. It's free, and you can read the whole 137 pages.
All right, so it sounds like you're saying that these are individuals who are gathering different things, like they have their own political grievance, they have their own take on the world, but they seem to be lining up with this particular wave of action. They're not acting in isolation.
No, absolutely, and that's why, you know, whenever I use the term lone wolf, I put so-called next to it because they're really part of an ecosystem. And you know, Tony was talking about how music, you know, back then, Screwdriver, for instance, and Rahoa and all these other bands. Today, you have a year-long, 24-hour-a-day hate rally music and bookstore available anytime, and a parent wouldn't let a fellow in a Nazi uniform with a swastika into their house or a Klansman, but they're coming in through the Wi-Fi.
So they're lone wolves only when they act, but they actually are coming from a very large pack of individuals that we have across the nation. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and let me say this, and we've been saying this for some time. In 2015, when I testified before Congress, shortly before the San Bernardino and Paris terror attacks, I said, hey, you know, violent Salafist jihadists represent the biggest risk. Now the most prominent one for some time has been white supremacist slash far right. So give an example. The year after I testified before Congress, there were only three in 2016, three white supremacist extremist homicides. Our data is a little different than the ADL's, but the trends are identical. So we counted three. Then the next year, 2017, 13. Last year, 2018, there were 17. Now this year alone, with El Paso, with Poway. We had some homicides in New York. We now have more white supremacist killings than all the extremist killings last year in domestic terror or hate incidents that involved fatalities. It's a terrible thing. And we really need folks to step it up with regard to treating this in the same way that they treated violent Salafist jihadists. Believe me, our community, San Bernardino, was hit by terrorism. And there was criticism that the Obama administration didn't respond quite as quickly as perhaps they should have. But I think any criticism of President Obama pales in comparison to what's going on with respect to white supremacist violence today. And the president and the administration have to step it up.
The number is 210-614-8980 for you to join our conversation. Ryan is on the line. Ryan, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey there. I'm just wanting to ask about how much of this is related to, you know, economics, like, you know, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, the Irish were very much scapegoated for this. How much of this is related to, you know, neo-Confederate, you know, the South, you know, the lost Civil War, and people are still peeved about that? And how much of this is related to, you know, a zero-sum thought process, where if I'm losing or if somebody else is winning, I'm automatically losing?
All right. Thank you for that. Economic factors, people who have talked a lot about the grievances. Brian Levin?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, it's hard to pinpoint one exact cause. And the data isn't as predictive or diagnostic as we like, but there are a lot of clues in that jigsaw puzzle. Let me give you an example. We saw a bump up in anti-Latino violence from about, let's say, 2003 approximately, let's say 2005 or 6, and it bounced around a bit. But its last decade, its last peak, if you will, was around 2010. And then it started declining for a few years. And what we saw concomitantly with that was a decline in unemployment, a healing of the stock market, and a decline in undocumented border crossings. So there's a correlation, but gosh, you know, we don't exactly know. In California, for instance, listen to this: 2015, we had an increase in hate crime off of a multi-year low. In 2014. And what we found was in California, where we became a plurality Latino state, anti-Latino hate crimes went up, but the country as a whole was flat. One other quick thing, though, about politics, because this question comes up a lot for us. We looked at anti-Latino hate crime in the days and couple of weeks after President Trump's campaign announcement. And what we found was anti-Latino hate crime actually went down during those days. But come November 2016, guess what? That was the worst month for hate crime overall in 14 years. The day after election was the worst day since 2003. And guess which group had the biggest percentage up? Latinos.
I'm going to go to Tony McAleer. He's a former skinhead recruiter. His book is called The Cure for Hate, A Former White Supremacist Journey from Violent Extremism to Radical Compassion. So, Tony, when you hear like what happens in El Paso or other attacks like on synagogues, what do you think about the shooter? And what assumptions do you make about that guy?
Well, it's certainly following a pattern, and I think Brian's absolutely right. The ecosystem of the internet is something really truly to consider. And I think I think it flies under the radar a little bit, because unlike ISIS and Al Qaeda, that have at least some semblance of a centralized command control structure, the world of white supremacy doesn't. It's the snake without a head. But I see, you know, often when I look into the histories of these people, like if you look at the histories of the young men who committed the ISIS attacks in Brussels and Paris, you see troubled young men. You see sometimes you see criminal records. You see drug use. There's often troubling factors in the background. And I think the key to dealing with this is we have to get them in the sort of pre-criminal space. We've got to work with troubled young men, you know, if for any other reason than to stop them killing people around us. And I think another thing that is certainly correlated, I'm not necessarily saying it's causal, but, you know, the rise in these attacks also corresponds with an epidemic of suicide amongst white men. And Princeton's done some fantastic studies on death by despair. And I think that underlying despair is what gives rise to a populist leader like Trump and other places around the world. And, you know, populism for me is it's an essential part to democracy. And it's like the engine light, check engine light going on in your car. It's a warning signal saying that there's something sort of systemically wrong. You better deal with it. You know, proceed at your own peril. It almost never offers the right solution, but it often asks the right question. And I think in these times of economic and upheaval and you know, people searching for answers, and more in particular searching for someone to blame, I think it's very easy for young men to be seduced into a very simple answer and solution, and to be able to project their despair into violence on other people, quite like I did.
So, Tony, do you still like monitor the activities online?
I don't personally monitor them so much. I rely on people like Brian or the ADL or the SPLC to monitor the activities. There's people that are much better at it than I am or we are as an organization at Life After Hate. You know, our focus really is to sort of off ramp and get to these young troubled people, hopefully before that they commit a mass killing in the name of white supremacy. And then there has been cases where some of our staff have had to deal with what was a credible potential school shooter, and we had to involve the family and the authorities and stuff like that. So it's, you know, that's not the expertise in the place where we want to be. That requires a much more professional level of of assistance. But we certainly know it when we recognize it.
So how's business? How are you doing? Are you seeing an uptick with people who are trying to, when all these shootings happen, are people realizing I'm in this group and this is not what I want, and they try to exit?
Yeah, or so up until Charlottesville, and we started Life After Hate in 2011, the six of us with the best of intentions and the lint in our pockets. We maybe helped 100 people up until 2017. Once Charlottesville hit, it went through the roof. It sort of awareness of us and such went through the roof. And what started to happen after Charlottesville is before was 100% individuals wanting to leave or having just left and trying to process what it was that they experienced their whole time in that movement. We started to get families and friends of, you know, concerned people around individuals involved reaching out to us. And now that's about half of the inquiries that we take. And since Charlottesville, we've had 241 calls for assistance, and that's just up to April of this year. I think in the last 3 months before April, we had 45 alone. So the load on our resources is growing
out.
And we're trying to figure out how do we do this at scale.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're talking about white extremism, how to find a cure for the hate, how to end the cycle of violence. We're talking with Tony McAleer. He's a former skinhead recruiter. Also, Brian Levin. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism. And you can call in. We're going to take your calls when we come back from this break. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues after this quick break.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about white male extremism and the shootings that are happening. What takes an individual who may feel angry, who may feel disconnected from society? They find groups online. Suddenly there's a script that they can take up, an ideology that they can impose onto themselves. Suddenly they some of them become shooters. They have these rampages like in El Paso. What happened? How can we intervene? The number to call in, 210-614-8980. Tony McAleer is one of our guests, former skinhead recruiter, co-founder and board chair of Life After Hate. He's got a book coming out, The Cure for Hate, A Former White Supremacist Journey from Violent Extremism to Radical Compassion. And Brian Levin is with us also, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. Just go to the phones, 210-614-8980 with Kathleen. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had a question for Mr. McAleer about what was the turnaround point? What made you decide you didn't want to be into being a skinhead anymore? What changed you?
All right, Kathleen, thank you for the call.
I would say that it was a moment that started a process. Of change. It wasn't an overnight change, but it was the birth of my daughter. It was being in the delivery room and being handed this beautiful little fragile baby girl, and she's got her eyes closed and scrunchy face, waving her arms, and she opens her eyes for the first time, and I connected to another human being for the first time since I could remember. When? Because, you know, for me to be in the movement as far as I was completely disconnected from my heart. I know we've talked about hate in the heart. I don't believe hate exists in the heart. It exists in the head. And it's allowed to exist in the heart, in the head, because we're cut off from our hearts. It's hate is in the ego. And I had a son 15 months later. And the beautiful thing about children is they love us unconditionally, and they don't see the flawed, weak, powerless person that I saw when I looked in the mirror. They see this magnificent person who's dead. And it became a safe place for me to allow my heart to thaw, to drop my guard and allow myself to feel again. Because, you know, the reason we close off from our feelings is because it's not safe to be open. And this was a safe place for me, and it started a process. But it did take some time, because the challenge, and this is the challenge I think you'll find with most of these young men, is that ideology and identity become intertwined. White supremacy wasn't something I believed in. It was the whole of my being. It was everything I thought and did. It was my identity. And when you try and argue with someone in that space, you can't attack the ideology without attacking their identity, and all the ego defense mechanisms come up. So we have to be careful to separate the identity from the ideology, and then the ideology can be tackled.
And Brian Levin, as Tony talks about, he had this disassociative syndrome happening with him with other individuals. And I guess when you think about someone who goes into a store and opens fire and kills 22 people, they must have a lack of empathy in order to do something so horrific and not really realize how much damage they're doing to a community. So it causing people to have more empathy, helping them to build empathy, is that a way to deal with this?
Certainly, and you know, it depends on the type of offender. You know, most offenders are not the kind that committed that massacre in El Paso. There were Levin and McDevitt, another Levin from Northeastern University, called mission offenders. But they have the most common offenders being thrill offenders, and then secondarily, there were others that were called reactive or defensive offenders. They're protecting pride, turf. The mission offenders are exactly what Tony was talking about. It's part of their being. But for the rest, It's what Dr. Robin Williams called a printed circuit of stereotypes. And that switch for the thrill offender is turned on by the desire for peer validation and in-group inclusion. But they might actually have friends from the group that they attack. The reactive offender might be dormant until something happens, some threat or some kind of perceived disrespect, similar like what gangs do when they see someone with another color clothing or something. But most offenders are not the hardcore mission offender, but when they act out, they tend to act out more violently. And one of the things we've been seeing, just give me 1 second here, even in the Texas cities, so for instance, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, all hit decade highs last year. Now, again, off of low numbers, so some of that's what we call catch-up or reporting effect. But the bottom line that I think is particularly disturbing is we're not only seeing an increase in overall hate crime, but we're seeing an increase in this domestic terrorism overlap with hate crime with these types of massacres. And that is something very concerning. And I think that had someone with another sounding name committed that offense, there would be a different kind of response. And I think that for all authorities, we have to recognize that this kind of ticking time bomb is a terrorist and is different than some of the more run-of-the-mill hate offenders, which are terrible, but aren't committed to the violence in the same way as these mission offenders are, kind of like what Tony used to be. By the way, he's the most affable, nice guy in person if you see him today.
Okay, I'll take your word for that. Sounds like a great endorsement, Tony. I'm going to go to Cole on the phones, 210-614-8980. Cole, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. The last thing I ever want to do is to not grieve over this extremism. It is a horrible grief that I have. I carry with me daily. But speaking as to possible causes of this, I often wonder, in an age where prejudice is seen to focus mainly upon minority groups, if perhaps we might think of the term reverse prejudice. Some of these young men that are snapping mentally, I wonder maybe if they feel that there's an onslaught of reverse prejudice simply because they were born into the Caucasian race. That's all I've got to say today.
Okay, Cole, thank you for that. Brian Levin, I'd love to hear your reaction.
Interesting perspective. You know, and one of the things like Tony was talking about, increase in suicides. We actually have a chart about life expectancy. For the first time in decades, life expectancy in the United States is going down. And it started with respect to white males. So that's something. Also, if you look at the younger demographic, according to Pew, they're online constantly. So if they have an assemblage of kind of unrelated grievances and fears and distrust, what this ideology that they come across because they're constantly online is one that not only legitimizes and explains their feelings, but also amps it up and directs where the aggression should go. So that's something. Last point, white nationalism is an international movement. And one of the things that we are seeing here in the United States, in places like Texas and in California, for instance, is that young people are in the most diverse demographic cohort ethnically. So many of them might feel socially isolated. They're online a lot. They have these grievances. They're cleaving from family. They're trying to make an identity into rough seas where the future is a bit opaque. And they're given something that's signed, sealed, delivered that explains all these fears and frustrations. And that's a problem.
So, Tony McAleer, can you talk about the hate? And was there almost like an addiction to the sensation, that amped up state of being in that hate? Is that an issue as well?
Pete Simi's done some incredible research around the addictive qualities of hate. I mean, I remember when I started getting into street fights, and I come from a soft middle class background, and hanging out with guys who were, you know, dodging punches as a child. But there was an adrenaline rush to it. There was definitely an element of of thrill seeking, and definitely, you know, coming from that place of powerlessness, the feeling of power when we walk down the street, you know, 10 of us and people cross the street to get out of our way. Those are intoxicating. I truly believe that for the most part, at the core of the issue for young men and women, because women are a part of it too, is what's called toxic shame. And I describe toxic shame as an impaired sense of self. It's an alienation of the self, which we live our lives in reaction to that feeling of being less than, of being worthless, of being less than human. And what's a word that's the opposite of shame? Pride. Right? And so you look at adopting these false pride narratives, proud boys, white pride worldwide, I'm proud of my race, all of that kind of stuff, is a compensation for that feeling of shame. Just as hanging out with violent skinheads for me was a compensation for that feeling of powerlessness. And so when we find that compensation, when we find that junk food solution, it is addictive. It eases the pain, if only momentarily. It eases the loss or the gap that's existing. And those are incredibly powerful drivers. We got a letter from a woman not long after Charlottesville, and she was worried about her son. She said, my son's 18, he's got Asperger's syndrome, and he's up to his eyeballs in this white nationalist stuff, and we don't know what to do. And she said, what terrifies me the most is that the white nationalists have embraced and accepted my son in a way that no one ever has in his entire life. You can imagine the isolation and social awkwardness that child experiences.
Right, and how he could become a tool for whatever their goals are. We're going to talk about the intervention on the hate and what is the goal of the white extremism movement. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. The source continues after a one-minute break. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about white extremism and these rampage attacks like we've seen at the Walmart in El Paso. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. David is on the line. Hi, David. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. So I'm trying to wrap my head around why white males have so much hatred. I mean, since the beginning of this country, they've had monetary power, they've had social power, they've had political power, and now that the playing field is sort of evening out, where people can have these opportunities as well, to me, I think it's just an excuse.
All right, David, thank you for that call. Brian Levin, well, you know, when people have power and it's taken away, or they think that they're losing power, is that a trigger? Is that something that's taking people from talking about their grievances to actually acting on them?
Oh, yeah. Look, I think that the fact that we have this demographic change going on, and it's most prominent in the younger cohort. So they're seeing this change. And interestingly enough, though, young people are more tolerant than their grandparents, but there are a lot of people in the country. So even if you have a relatively small number that are going to take these fears and grievances and then change them and amp them into an ideology, that's going to be a very strong emotional component. With regard to prejudice, there are three parts: the cognitive and experiential. And then there's the emotive, and then there's the behavioral. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is a scripted violence that is taking place. And I think Tony made a really great point. When he was doing this, it was really kind of more on the street. Now folks are finding allies and co-conspirators and aiders and abettors with people who had committed terrorist acts in the past or who have written racist screeds. And they feel that by committing an act of violence and memorializing in some way, that they're becoming part of this chain. And interestingly enough, the El Paso assailant wrote about how he won't be able to get a job and that kind of thing. And he talked about automation and replacement and all this stuff. So what happens is classic scapegoating. But they're seeing a world that is changing and one that they think is leaving them out.
So, Tony McAleer, what is the goal? What is the mission? Okay, so like a shooter, I know you can't talk specifically about the El Paso Walmart shooter or these other shooters, but if they have some sort of political agenda they're trying to act on, how is shooting up a bunch of strangers and then possibly even being killed yourself in the process, how does that accomplish anything?
Well, I mean, these are, you know, they're somewhat irrational acts, so it's hard to rationally explain them. But if I go back to when I was involved, I thought I'd be dead or in jail as a white revolutionary at the age of 20. When Robert Matthews and the Order, which was which what we would call today a domestic terrorist organization that came out of Aryan Nations, that murdered a Denver radio talk show host, Alan Berg, that robbed an armored car in Ukiah, California, for $3.5 million that was never recovered, died in a fiery shootout on Whidbey Island at, with the FBI. But those guys were legendary. They were heroes. And what Matthews said he was trying to do was to fire the first shot in the second American Revolution. And I think the challenge is this ideology gets mixed up with all kinds of, there's all kinds of fantasies around violence. There's all kinds of, it's mixed in with icons and Norse mythology and the warrior ideal, you know. And I think the crisis in masculinity amongst young men, I think, contributes to why those things are so attractive. And I think, you know, on the surface, it's about intimidation. It's about, we want a whites only homeland. And you know, these shootings will make people think twice about whether they want to settle in the United States at the rawest form. But underneath, there's lots of people who I think fantasize about doing shootings like that, but you know, they don't have the guts to pull it off. But that is sort of in a nutshell of the thinking as I remember it.
So Brian Levin, director of the Center for Study of Hate and Extremism, is there some sort of currency with doing these type of acts in that social circle, and that becomes what these individuals value more even than their own life?
In some cases, yes. And what is so interesting is there is a supporting folklore to this with various books like reference, like the Turner Diaries, which was used not only by the Order, who named themselves after the group in the book and then did this assassination hit list and this armored car heist, but Timothy McVeigh, this idea of leaderless resistance, unlike violent Salafist jihadists from like Al-Qaeda and Daesh, where you have a much more regimented information flow and how to interpret things, this is much less scripted and more personal. And that's why, in some ways, we're seeing, I think, this increase after these groups have imploded post-Charlottesville. They thought that they could get pride by being out in public and mainstream and having their message in politics, but they found that their message might have been let in, but not them. So what we have is a very stealth, leaderless-oriented kind of movement that glorifies leaderless resistance and these kind of white warriors who will take these sheep and lead them through some scripted acts of individual violence. They think a few of these is going to turn the country.
All right, so Brian Levin, the FBI has come out and said this is a threat to the United States, and they got pushback from Congress when they put out that report. A particular congressman, Mike Pompeo, was one of the first and the loudest to say this is a political statement, not an actual assessment of threat to the United States. Mike Pompeo is now the Secretary of State. Is the United States dedicating enough resources to fight this threat?
No, and he was wrong. And this is the problem when we have politicians trying to direct where
our assets should go, and it's terribly wrong. When the threat was from violent Salafist jihadists, our center called it and eerily called it, and we did it again. And it's time we stop the political garbage and start approaching this as a domestic security threat. This is domestic terrorism, and I think if the guy was named Ahmed, we'd have a different response. We have to look at the threat and not the political ramifications of it. Because I'll tell you something, I'm friends with a fellow who worked at DHS and came out with a pretty darn good report in 2009, and he was pilloried for it, and it turned out he was prescient. We have this threat, and it's going. And let me just tell you one other quick thing. One of the things that we've also seen is an increase in violence around politics and political events now. So we're seeing over the last decade, the worst months for hate crime were around, for instance, elections and Charlottesville. So we have to tone it down and let the evidence take us where to go with respect to how we allocate our domestic terrorism resources and not politics. It's wrong.
And Tony McAleer, in your skinhead sphere that you come encounter with and the hate individuals and their groups, is there a political line of thought? Do they think that some of the political leaders that we have in the United States support them?
Well, you know, the alt-right, the world of white nationalism, it's not a unified, coherent political or ideological. It's a mishmash of all kinds of sometimes competing, sometimes hypocritical perspectives and viewpoints. And I think there's some on that spectrum which are very supportive of the president. But we also know that the Tree of Life killer, murderer. He was very anti-Trump. Thought Trump was a sellout and a shill. So there's lots on that side that don't like Trump, and there's lots that do. But it's by any means not a cohesive, unified body.
So Tony, what would you want to see happen to end this cycle of violence?
It's funny, Jamie Raskin asked me this when I was testifying before Congress, you know, what would you do with $1 billion? And I think, and Life After Hate asks the question of itself, how do we become scalable? And the answer is, this is not something we can do alone, but we need to empower local communities. I think initiatives need to start not from the federal government down, but from the county level up. And what we've developed is, for example, a training which will help law enforcement, social workers, mental health people recognize white nationalists or white supremacists when they encounter them. And we've also got evidence-based training to help them engage with them better. And I think that we just need to empower local communities so we can spot these kids in trouble at an early stage and off-ramp them, help them out, and do that in communities across the country. And I think by the time we wait for the person to become a shooter, it's obviously way too late. We need to get in there early in the pre-criminal space.
And Brian Levin, in about a minute, what would you do?
Well, first of all, I would have our political leaders tone it down. And I think Tony made a great point. You know, going into Charlottesville, Trump was actually quite popular. I'm not saying that he's a racist or not. I'll leave that to others. But among the extremists that I interviewed and that we saw on the web, he had a lot of support. However, he is now regarded by many as a traitor and a do-nothing and all talk. And I think what we need to do is have the leadership come from on high. I think the bully pulpit is important, and if it's not in Washington, D.C., where I'm at, let it be in the communities. Also, groups like his, Life After Hate, I think we have to fund it. They got a grant and they were defunded. We have to make this a priority, and it's more than just one or two things. But those, I think, are the most notable ones. Bully pulpit, asset allocation, and taking it seriously so that we can track as much as we can without violating civil liberties.
And if good people come together and stand up against hate, we can put this in a box and put it away, hopefully, for a very, very long time. Tony McAleer, thank you so much. Life After Hate, this organization, The Cure for Hate, is the book. Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Ross Piedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director.